I also think that wealth is a link between today and the past and the future, the sacrifices, the compromises that you had to make for the money to even be here today for us to talk about it. But tell me more how you see wealth, like your children.
I first heard it from Peter Bernstein, who's one of my favorite authors and financial historian, right? And he's one of the best guys who want to learn about risk in investing. So it was Peter who said that your wealth is like your children, and they are the it's a primary link between your present and the future, like your children, right? Right. So he also said that you should try to think about it in the same way. You want your children to have freedom, but you also want them to be good people who can take care of themselves, right? So in the same way, when it comes to wealth, right, you need to be having the freedom to use that wealth for your advantage to live a life that you want to do. But you also need to, like, you want your kids to be good people who can take care of themselves, responsible people. You also have that responsibility of managing your wealth well, right? It's not just about freedom, because freedom without responsibility is mania, is havoc, right? I think one of the simplest ideas that I think about, and I think about a lot, is that the sequence matters, right? Make lose is different than lose make, right? Once you make something, once you build wealth, or once you do the right things to build wealth when you are younger, right, you can still lose a part of it and still survive. But if you start with a loss, and you start with a big loss, then it's very difficult to make that up again. If you blow it away, it's a very rare thing that you're going to get a second chance to building it. So when you invest, right, it's not your wealth. Again, this is what Peter says, it's not your wealth. It's your future that you are really managing.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is Vishal Khandelwal. He's the founder of Safal Niveshak, an investor education initiative. He's an independent analyst, financial writer. He says that he spends 75% of waking time reading. He's the author of The Sketchbook of Wisdom, a handcrafted manual on the pursuit of wealth and good life. I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful book packed with wisdom of the ages, from Lord Krishna to Socrates, Charlie Munger, and Warren Buffett and beyond. Vishal also published Mental Models, Investing, and You, which covers ideas from various disciplines from psychology, economics, business, mathematics, to literature, statistics, and more. Today, we take on some big questions. First, we'll hear Vishal's thoughts on what is life about beyond eating and making money. We talk about kindness and how to be okay when things are not. My guest shares ideas about the concept of freedom, a topic that came up many times on the show. I really enjoy hearing about minimizing the cost of being wrong, which is at the essence of my own investment philosophy. We dive into a beautiful image that our wealth is like our children, our primary link between the present and the future. Stay tuned until the end when Vishal tells me if money can buy happiness. Please help me welcome Vishal Khandelwal. Hi, Vishal. How are you? It's so nice to see you.
Hi, Bogomil. So nice to see you as well. And thank you for this opportunity to host me on your wonderful podcast. I've been listening to it for a while, and I'm glad and honored to be a part of it today. So thank you so much from myself.
I'm a big fan of your work, your podcast, your writing. And as I told you, I've been listening to your voice for so long, so I feel like I know you very well. We have a mutual friend, Harry, in Bangkok that connected us. So thank you, Harry. I'm sure he's listening. I want to jump right in. I have a lot of questions, but you know how I like to start these conversations with the early days, childhood, and upbringing. So if you indulge me, can you talk about that time and how you think that time shaped you, your curiosity about money, life, investing, and wealth?
My life has been a series of accidents and adventures, which I had no clue about what was supposed to happen, right? Like it happens with everyone or probably most of us, right? So I grew up in a middle-income household in the northern part of India. Initially did my schooling from a boarding school in a place called Dehradun, and then moved to northern western state of Rajasthan, to do my schooling for the remaining part of my schooling, staying with my family that time, right? So those were just normal days, usual days growing up. Nothing that I remember from that time, which is like that I think. Serves me a great lesson at this point of time. But yeah, just living a normal life, a normal middle class life in India, right? Growing up, getting a good education. So in India, if you're a middle class family, or even if you are not middle class, right, any class that you talk about, any section of the society, we lay a lot of focus on education, right? So that was also the thing in my household. Thankfully, we were surrounded by some folks and we had a good quality education that we were offered throughout my growing up years, and that really helped me in terms of pursuing a career which is in the knowledge economy that we are doing at this point of time. So I did my schooling from there, then I also did my undergrad in commerce, and then I came to Bombay, which is Mumbai now, to do my MBA in finance, right? So that happened in somewhere in 2001, 2003 when I did my MBA. Now, from there on, I moved into a career in equity research, which is stock market research. And that was, again, the first major accident that happened with my life, and a lucky accident at that. I never wanted to get into stock markets. I had no clue what the stock market is all about, except the fact that during my MBA, I had read a book on one of the wisest investors and one of the richest persons in the world, that was Warren Buffett. And that was just a passing thing for me, right? So, okay, there's a rich person, there's something called a stock market. So we had heard, or I had heard about stock markets at my household. My father used to trade in stocks, so not invest. He used to trade in stocks back then. And there were a couple of major bull markets where he actually traded in stocks and lost some money out there. So there was the 1992 Harshad Mehta scam that happened, where as a family, we lost some money. And of course, almost everyone who was trading in stocks that time, without an inkling of whether they were investing or trading, they lost a lot of money. And then, of course, there was a 2000.com boom and bust just while I was getting into college, right? A 2000.com bubble burst out there, and there was a lot of wealth erosion all around. So that was my only introduction to stock markets, that it's a dangerous place to be in, right? You can lose a lot of money and you can lose your entire peace. And sometimes people, when I saw around some friends of my father's, right, they would also borrow money to invest, right? So, or trade rather, and they lost a lot of money, some reputation lost here and there as well. So that was my only introduction. So I never wanted to get into stock markets. I wanted to get into foreign exchange markets. But 2003, when I was finishing up with my MBA, the only one job that came to my lab, or that the only company that came to a college for placements, was an equity research company. I was an MBA in finance, no job in hand. And it so happened that I had promised my to-be wife that I would marry her as soon as I get a job, right? Otherwise, her family would have married her somewhere else. So for that reason, I came
extra
to Bombay.
Motivation.
Yes. So for that reason, I came to Bombay is to finish my MBA fast, to get a job fast, to get the first job in hand. Uh-huh. And in hindsight, that turned out to be a lucky accident because of that promise to my to-be wife, who's my wife now, right? I joined the stock markets as an equity research analyst in 2003. And that, if you remember, that was the start of a bull market across the world. And for the next 5 years till 2008, we had seen one of the best bull markets that you could have ever seen, right? So in India, I remember the benchmark index, the Sensex, actually moved from some 3,000 levels to 21,000 levels within a span of 5-6 years. That was amazing, right? So you saw a lot of people making money. You saw your recommendation. I saw my recommendations, stock tips, stock recommendations, making a lot of money for shareholders. And at the start of your career, when you see your stocks performing and all your predictions coming through, you start believing that you're a master of the universe and you've arrived and you've known everything, right? But that is when 2008 came in, and that is where you realize, okay, investing is different than trading, right? And this someone who is known as Warren Buffett, who's not just the richest person in the world, but also one of the wisest investors out there. Of course, there's also even a wiser person, I would think, that is Charlie Munger, who's Buffett said at that point of time. So I did not reach much about Charlie Munger that time, but that is where my introduction to Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger came in. And that is where the entire trajectory of my life in terms of not just investing, but also in terms of decision-making, thinking, how to live a life actually changed for the better that I came across these two wonderful individuals somewhere around 2007-8. 2008 is when I decided that this is not my cup of tea in terms of recommending stocks, writing research reports and recommending stocks to unknown people, unknown faces across age groups. And that is where I decided that maybe in a few years, once I am financially, not financially free, but once I have no liability on my head. So I had one housing loan and a mortgage at that point of time. So I wanted to pay that off and then quit my job to start something of my own. What to start? I had no idea. I wanted to continue in the stock markets, but in a manner that would offer me much more peaceful life than recommending stocks or money managing other people's money. So that is where the seeds of what I am doing now for the last 11, 12 years, which is Safal Niveshak, which is a Hindi term for successful investor, which is a place where I try to educate people about how not to lose their hard-earned money, and which I've been trying to do for the last 11, 12 years now. So that is where the seeds got sown in, and last 12 years have passed on like a fly, and I am here today talking to you about all that experience. So, yeah.
Wow, what an incredible story. There are so many little moments in your life that really mattered. First of all, I'm thinking about the importance of education, that your family put a lot of emphasis on something that I can relate to. I grew up with the same principles and ideas. I like the moment that you mentioned about the early loss that your family experienced in the stock market combined with you joining the stock market at the beginning of a bull market, which is an interesting dichotomy right there. Because on one hand, I think you realize it's not that easy. And then it felt like, wow, it's really easy. Stocks go up and all of them go up, right? So two very different moments. And then the element of luck, getting married and making the decision real quick to accept the job and finding the right book. A lot of people pick up the wrong book or take a long time to find the right book.
I cannot emphasize more the idea of finding the right mentors early in your life, Mogul. So sometimes it happens for a lot of people late in their lives that they find the right people whom they should have found much earlier. So it was a lucky break for me that 2008 happened, that I diverted my mind from stock markets to learning about what really matters in investing. And it's not just about stock price. It's largely about how people behave in stock markets. It's not about short-term thinking. It's about long-term thinking, right? It's not about stock price. It's about businesses, right? So these ideas came to me much earlier in my career, maybe after the first 5 years when I started thinking too highly of myself. But yeah, was brought on ground by 2008 and found those mentors, distant mentors, right? So I think I cannot emphasize much about how important it is. Yeah.
Speaking of mentors, your wonderful book, The Sketchbook of Wisdom, a handcrafted manual on the pursuit of wealth and good life. It's a collection of lessons from a variety of mentors. Many of them are obviously no longer with us in ancient times as well. Tell me more about that book. How did it come about? It's a collection of lessons from a variety of mentors. It's a collection of lessons from a variety of mentors. Many of them are obviously no longer with us. Some of them lived in the ancient times. Tell me more about that book. How did it come about? And I know you're not marketing it. People are finding it. A friend of mine, Harry, that I mentioned, sent me a copy of your book. Tell me more how this book came about.
So I think, something that just suddenly came out of the blue for me, an idea of writing a book and not on investing. So after being in the investing industry for so many years, I had initially thought that I would write a book on principles of investing, which I did not do. And the idea of sketchbook came in during the COVID epidemic, and we were in a lockdown across the world, right? And I was talking to my son, right? So I used to draw in illustrations on investing and stock markets and everything. And he loves illustrations. He loves storytelling, right? So it was his idea that I should combine all that to create a book, right? It was also some way his idea that, okay, it should not be a boring book. And because that not boring thing, I skipped the idea about stock market. And I thought that I would write a much more broader book for a much more broader audience than just investors. So I think the inspiration came first from this great author called Leo Tolstoy, the Russian author, right? Whom I had read about that while on his deathbed somewhere in 1885. He completed his collection of reading from some of the wisest people who've ever walked the earth, people like Epictetus, people like Marcus Aurelius, Lao Tzu, Gautam Buddha and everything, right? And around 17 years prior to when he died, when he was completing this collection, right? He actually wrote to his assistant that it gave him great inner force. It gave him a lot of calmness, a lot of happiness to communicate with such great thinkers, because they tell us, despite not being there in front of us, they tell us about what is the most important thing for humanity, right? What is the meaning of life? What is the thing about virtue, right? So he wrote that he wanted to create a book for himself in which he could tell a person that was him and also the world out there about his life and about the good way of life. And 17 years later, after he conceptualized this idea, when on his deathbed, he actually finished that project that is now known as a book called A Wise Thought for Every Day. And I highly recommend that book to you. And if you've not read that, to everyone out there, A Wise Thought for Every Day by Leo Tolstoy. So it's like a calendar. It's like a diary that he's written, right? And he's collected these ideas from various philosophers and thinkers out there from history, ancient history. And there's this philosopher and writer, John Rousseau, that Tolstoy mentions in his book, right? And the quote from Rousseau that he mentions is that real wisdom is not the knowledge of everything, right? But the knowledge of which things in life are necessary, which things are less necessary, and which things are completely unnecessary to me. Right? So we need to know the differentiation about what we should be spending our time knowing in the limited amount of time that we have on this planet, right? And as per Rousseau, among the most necessary knowledge is the knowledge of how to live well, right? That is how to produce the least possible evil and the greatest goodness in one's life, right? So he wrote to his assistant that at present that people study useless science, which I think is true in today's world as well, right? But they forget to study the most important knowledge, which is how to live a good life, right? There's another entry in Tolstoy's book where he's quoted one of the greatest ancient and medieval texts on Hinduism, which is the Vishnu Puran, right? And he pulled out a quote from Vishnu Puran that mentions that there is only one real knowledge, right? And what is that? That is which helps us to be free, right? Every other type of knowledge he says and he quotes from Vishnu Puran is a mere amusement which we should not be wasting our time on. Now, when it comes to the sketchbook, I think the thoughts and ideas that I have tried to compile in that, they are there because they have helped me learn about my life and about the good way of life, right? And I think the lessons from some of the wisest people I have written about, Charlie Munger, Aristotle, Socrates, right, Gautam Buddha, Gandhi, Marcus Aurelius, so many people, Warren Buffett, even modern-day thinkers like Naval Ravikant, Morgan Housel, right? So all of these lessons, probably most of these lessons have helped me through the darkest hours of my life. And they've helped me to walk on this journey to free myself from the chains of all the emotions that we go through. Things like fear, things like anxiety, sorrow, worry, greed, envy, right? Which is typical for any investor or for any human being to live with. Now, I would not say that after having written the book and after having learned these lessons that I am living a perfect life. It's far from that. It's far from perfect. I still have my anxieties and sorrows and greeds and envies, all those kind of things, right? But I think the lesson is that the timeless wisdom that I have read and I have researched about while writing this book and the entire idea of just writing this book and creating this book, this wisdom has helped me walk on this path of sanity and serenity, right? And I think my biggest idea of sketchbook was to share these ideas like Tolstoy, not just with myself and my kids, but also with anyone who would care to read. So I think I published this book almost 2.5 years back, and over time I've realized that I wish I had read such kind of a book earlier in my life, though I've read much variations and many good variations, much better books out there, but something which compiles all these lessons into a book which I think also looks good not just in terms of sharing good stuff, but also looks good in terms of the colors and illustration, which I like reading, right? So, and now I wish that my kids and other young people around me also read a book like this or something like that, where because we are living in a world, right, where the age-old wisdom has taken a backseat to all the information and noise out there. And most of that in today's world is fake, right? And there's a lot of confusion and anxiety all around there in the minds of young people. Right? So these are the reasons I think I've written this book, Bogomil. And by the way, I think I find myself a bit selfish in saying that I have been the biggest beneficiary of the entire exercise of creating this book, including drawing all of its illustrations by hand, right? So just going back to the timeless wisdom that is contained in the pages, right? When I discuss them about with my kids and other young people out there, and when I try to simplify further, that helps me understand those ideas even clearly, right? And that helps me in taking a better account of my life and what purpose I'm here for. So I think overall, I've been the biggest beneficiary, and that's probably the reason I wrote that book in the first place. Yeah.
I think the best books are written for yourself, and even better if they're written for a younger self, a book that I wish I had in my hands when I was 18, 17, when I had all the questions in the world and so few answers. And it took a while to read many books, fill in the gaps, and I don't think the process is done. I think the exciting part is how many things I don't know yet, and about how many things I will still change my mind. That gets me really excited. And part of this podcast project is finding different answers to the questions that I already thought I know, and then the new ones come up. But I like the idea of freedom. You mentioned how certain knowledge can lead to freedom. Tell me more about that feeling of freedom. How do you know you have it? How do you know you arrived?
So I think, freedom, Bogomil, is a concept dear to me as well. And I also talk about freedom, and I also seek answers about freedom to people who I invite in my podcast as well. And when it comes to the sketchbook and the idea of freedom that I talked about in the book, I think I talked about a Greek philosopher, which is Diogenes, right, who lived around 300 BC. And who was, I think, one of the most famous advocate of the school of thought, which is known as cynicism, right? So cynicism is basically a school of thought where for the followers, right, the purpose of life is to live in virtue, in agreement with nature. And cynics are those who believe that people could gain a lot of happiness by living in a way which is natural for themselves, which is free, right? And they reject all conventional desires for wealth, for power, for fame, and all stuff like that. Right. On the other hand, I think their ideas is generally to lead a simple life, free from all possessions and free from all stuff that most mankind is after. Right. So coming back to this story about Diogenes, right? He was a Greek philosopher. He lived in extreme poverty out of his own choice. Right. And the best part about him that I read, of whatever little I have read, is that he was not afraid to speak the truth. Right. And also the fact that he spoke harshly of those who were willing to give up the freedom of thought and belief for temporary pleasures and safety. Right? As I also learned that he wanted people to reclaim their freedom and dignity and live with complete honesty, with complete self-respect and complete independence of mind. Right? He believed that happiness could be achieved through radical simplicity, extreme simplicity. And he argued that we humans have complicated almost every simple gift of God's, right? Everything that we've given by God's and the world, right? All simple stuff, right? We've not even kept that simple. We've complicated it massively, right? So he spoke about the need for us to cut back on the clutter and complexity of life. He also talked about the idea of rediscovering the simple gifts that nature affords, right? Things like health, things like freedom, which are all free, right, out there, but we don't claim that because we are running for some other mirage, right, in our idea of hedonic adaptation, right? Just to give I think there's this very interesting or probably funny story about Diogenes, right? When one day this mighty ruler Alexander the Great, he pays a visit to this philosopher who's living in a barrel, right, and who's apparently needing nothing, right? So a bare minimum life that he's leading. And Alexander the Great, who heard of Diogenes, he came to visit him, right? And Alexander was supposedly the most powerful person in the world that time, but he was still struck by Diogenes' condition, and he asked him out of generosity, what can I do to help you, right? So he asked Diogenes, and instead of asking for riches, for gold or power or something, Diogenes simply asked, can you please stand a little out of my sun, right? You're blocking my sun, right? So I think that surprised Alexander so much that he He was also impressed by the man's audacity of asking the king of the world just to get out of the sun, right? Just to get out his way and let the sun come in, right? And so he tells Diogenes that if I were not Alexander, I would want to be Diogenes. He was so impressed. But again, to this point, Diogenes replies that if I were not Diogenes, I would still want to be Diogenes. Right? So I'm sure you agree with this, that I think it takes a lot of courage to be an individual and a self-disciplined person. If you want to be a person of genuine character, if you want to cultivate a zone of independence in your life, right, and grant yourself the freedom to be who you are, I think that's such important ideas to live by. So the story of Diogenes that I cover in this chapter on freedom, I think Diogenes believed that humans, we've lost touch with reality. Everyone you see around, or most people we see around, are living completely inauthentic lives. They're not true to themselves, but true to what others think of themselves. Like, same the idea of inner versus outer scorecard that Warren Buffett talks about. Right. So the idea has not changed. The idea of freedom has not changed. It's only that we've ourselves caged, we've caged ourselves in a reality that we think is true, which is not true in the real sense. Right. Right. The lesson on freedom from that chapter on Diogenes is that I think if we can strive to live the way he prescribed, which means with complete freedom and complete independence, I think we would be able to achieve what we really aspire for, which is truly free and a truly happy life. So I think that was the lesson on freedom that I wanted to capture in this lesson on Diogenes, my chapter.
That's beautifully put. And I think to me, the big thing, the big question is, what's enough? What's your enough? And he had his enough very clear. His identity to him was very clear, who he is, who he wants to be. What do you think he would think of today because of the world we're living today? I think the world he lived in was a lot simpler, less stimulating, less distracting than the world we're living in. Today, even in my life, I'm 43, but I've seen the world change so much in terms of technology, smartphones, new social media, how things quickly spread, and some of the things that spread maybe are not worth spreading. What do you think he would have thought of the world today?
No, I think if the Diogenes were living today, probably he would have wanted to go back to his times, I suppose, rather than continue state today, despite all the technology and comforts of life that we have today, right? Technology and other stuff that we have that make life easier, but also difficult in a way that we have so many choices. Life has sort of become so easy for a lot of us, right? That we have stopped being grateful for the simple pleasures and simple stuff that we have. To live a good life, right? It's so easy to not be grateful about things that we have. Just the idea that we are sitting in two different continents, so far from each other, and talking and conversing about ideas from Diogenes and ideas on freedom and all this kind of stuff. I think on a real-time basis, I think is a miracle in itself that nobody would have imagined a few years back. But given all this, I think given all this backdrop, right? I think people have also sort of become less free, if I were to use that word, right? As I mentioned, we've caged ourselves. We used to cage ourselves earlier in our self-created cages, and we are still probably living in the same kind of a world that this as I see around, right? Just look at the idea of wealth, right? There's so much wealth that has been created for people out there. We have access to everything, right? But I think people have a wrong notion about wealth, right? People have a wrong notion about wealth. It's not the same as income, right? We are spending our way out of poverty or whatever it is that you call, right? But I think I would not say the entire humanity, but so many people out there who have access to everything, I think we are living less freer lives. We are running races which are rat races, right? We are running after mirages called wealth and freedom, I think, which I don't think is the right way of live, right way to live. I think the right way to live is to be true to yourself. Whatever the world that we are living in, the right way to live is, I think, is to be true to your principles, the kind of person that you are. Coming back to the same example, same idea of inner versus outer scorecard of Warren Buffett, or the idea of playing a single player game that Naval Ravikant talks about, right? We all in this mirage of wealth creation, this mirage of getting better than others, right, on a relative basis, we are all trying to play multiplayer games, as Naval Ravikant said, right? We are all living a life with the outer scorecard, which I think is not a good idea. So the earlier is the lesson that we understand about the freedom that we have today, the access to everything good that we have today, right? And the earlier we become responsible towards that, right, I think the better off we are.
How does the saying go? Spending money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't like. I think it goes something along those lines.
I think authentic is the right word that I think you mentioned, right? So whatever condition that you live in, whether in a barrel or not in a barrel, whether at home or in the Himalayas, right? I think just being authentic to yourself and the kind of virtues that you believe in and the kind of principles that you live by, whatever comes, I think that is the idea of freedom that we can still pursue in a world that is different, much different from what Diogenes was living in 300 BC.
Very much so. Before I ask you the next question, what I like about your book is that the ideas that you present, they were relevant 2,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, and they're relevant today. And something tells me that they will be relevant in the future. And I think that's something very special about finding those ideas out there, that you can carve them in a stone and know that they will make a difference in people's life today, tomorrow, way far in the future. And there's so much out there that's being written and shared that will expire by the end of the day or by the end of the week. But to actually find things that are meant to last, and your book is full of those ideas, there's something special about that. And one of the big ones, one of the chapters that I really like, is about the real meaning of life. And you kind of touched on it earlier, but I wanted to explore it a bit more. You say that living is not just about eating and making money. What is it about, Vishal?
So again, Akeda, I think it sounds like a very serious question, or sometime, or probably people will also think that you're mad when you go out seeking, what do you mean by the meaning of life, or what's the real meaning of life? But I think it's a very simple question, as I'll come to it, right? Just talking about the chapter where I talk about the meaning of life, right? So I wrote this chapter in context of a person called George Mallory, right? Who's supposedly even the first person to have climbed Mount Everest, even like probably 30 years before even Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay began their ascent to the Everest, right? So, and Mallory actually wrote a book called Climbing Everest, which is probably one of the best accounts of climbing this highest peak in the world, right? So in that book, there's this passage where a journalist asked question to Mallory about why he would risk his life to attempt to reach the daunting Everest at the very first place. And when I read this profound response, I thought that it outlined a powerful way, probably an undeniably powerful way to perceive life and the meaning of life, right? So Mallory replied, as he mentioned in his book, that people often ask me, and I may be missing some of the words and things here and there, but broadly he said that people ask me, like you are asking me as a journalist, what is the use of climbing Mount Everest? And my answer should be that it is of no use. And this is the answer which I give. It is of no use climbing Mount Everest, right? There is no prospect of gaining any gold or silver out there, right? We may learn a little about the behavior of human body at high altitudes, right? And probably doctors and people in medicine, they may turn our observation to some research or some account, right? For the purpose of treating people, or also for the purpose of aviation, because we are talking about higher heights, right? But nothing else will come out of it. We shall not bring a single bit of gold or gem or coal or iron, right? He also says that if you cannot understand that there is something in a person, something in a man which responds to the challenge of this mountain and goes out to meet it, that the struggle is the struggle of life itself, upward and forever upward, then you will not see why we go to Mount Everest, right? And Mallory then says that what we get from this adventure is just sheer joy and nothing more, right? And joy, after all, is the end of life. We do not live to eat and make money, he says. We eat and make money to be able to live. And that is what life means and what life is for. I think that's, if you just read it again and again, or listen to it, this passage again and again about Mallory's response to why would you risk your life to climb Mount Everest? What do you get out of it? I think it's such a beautiful response to such a mundane question, isn't it? And not just that, I think in an interview much later, when someone asked him as to why do you want to climb Mount Everest, right? His simple reply was, because it's there, right? These have been called the most famous three words in mountaineering, right? It was the mountain that provided Mallory a focus. It was the mountain that gave him a reason to live, a meaning to his life, and that was it, right? So coming back to the same question, right? What is the meaning of life? I think, as I mentioned, it sounds like a serious question. Sometimes it also sounds like a mad question. And people imagine right. that the answer must be complicated. But whatever little I know of, I think it's such an important question. I also ask this question to people in my podcast. A lot of them tell me their own version of the meaning of life. Some also say there's no meaning to life. But okay, my understanding is that the answer is not too hard to understand. There is a meaning to life. And as per my understanding, I think the meaning of life is simply what makes you feel alive, right? It may be writing, it may be mountaineering, it may be dancing, it may be investing, podcasting, for example, it may be simply serving others, right? It is as simple as mm-hmm. that. So it's never perfect. So life is never perfect. And like Mallory wrote to that told that journalist, right? Life is not about eating and making money, right? You need to face adversities. You need to be that man in the arena, right? You need to face challenges head on. You need to step away from what is comfortable and what is familiar. You need to get into the unknown, right? Because when you do that, right, when you get into that unknown, right, that is what brings us real joy in life over a period. Right? If you survive, of course, you don't need to get yourself killed. But if you survive, right, you just become stronger and you just become happier because you've achieved something. Right. I think the crux of it is, I think that is what gets us life's real worth, its real meaning. And that was my idea behind writing this chapter in the sketchbook. I think, in short, it was a lesson to myself. Right. Go beyond the obvious. Go beyond your comfort zone and do what you want to do in life, what you enjoy doing in life rather than what others want to do in life. So I think you'll find your life's meaning one way or the other.
Very much so. I wrote down the word joy, and it's the big joy and the small joys of life. And whether it's a fun conversation that opens up your mind to something new. One night I'm sitting down, I'm reading an annual report of a company and getting to know a new business model. And my wife is asking, what are you reading? And I said, an annual report. And to me, it doesn't feel like work. It's something that I would be reading because I'm curious. I'm curious how they figured it out. How does the business work? It just brings me joy that I'm discovering something that I didn't know before. And I'm always mesmerized. To me, when people say, oh, is this work? Is this not work? I don't have those lines and boundaries in my life. I just enjoy the process. I'm getting ready for this interview and rereading your book and writing down questions. I was walking around with a big smile with all the things I wanted to ask you. That's joy to me as well, big and small, it doesn't matter. So collecting those little moments throughout life, I think that's what it's all about. And they're very different for different people. If I made somebody else read an annual report at 10 o'clock on a Saturday, maybe they would cry and I smile. So what makes me happy doesn't have to make somebody else happy. And finding your own source of joy is important. Vishal, I want to ask you about being kind. You have a chapter about being kind, and I'm close to that topic. I've been thinking about it a lot. I wrote about it. I wrote an article, Return on Kindness, after coming back from Omaha last year and meeting so many wonderful people. Talk to me about kindness. I feel like it's something so obvious, but somehow maybe we forget about it.
I think it's a very important concept, a concept that spans ages, right? So people have talked about kindness 2000 years back and people are still talking about kindness as one of the most important virtues, right? So we study biographies, we look at annual reports, we find successful people all around, right? And when we study such successful people, right, or personalities, we generally always talk about their work ethic, we talk about their creativity, we talk about their leadership skills and everything, right? So without doubt, I understand that these things are very essential and we can learn a lot from them, right? But one thing I think that gets less attention is whether they were kind to others in their journey, right? So I always, when I talk about the idea of kindness, and this is one of my favorite ideas, I always give people, especially young people, the example of Warren Buffett, again, one of the most successful people in the world, right? So successful by all senses of the word, right? Since we're talking about success here and kindness here, right? So I remember in one lecture that he was giving to college students and he was asked his definition of success, right? And he replies that when you get to my age, right, you will really measure your success in life by how many of the people you want to have love you, actually love you, right? That is, mm-hmm. as per Buffett, the ultimate test of how you have lived your life. And he also tells students that the trouble with love is that you cannot buy it, right? It's not available somewhere. The only way to get love is to be lovable. The more you give it away, the more you get it. It's like the law of karma, right? Now just understand this, right? A self-made billionaire says that the amount you are loved, not your wealth or accomplishments, that is the ultimate measure of success in life. And he also says that the only way to get love is to be lovable, right? I think kindness is that path to it. To be lovable and to get all the love that you want to be in life, you just need to be kind. And it's not difficult. It's fundamental to our existence. I think kindness is sewn into the fabric of our DNA. It's only that we forget in the rigors of life over a period of time in running our own races that we start being unkind sometime. But by nature, by DNA, by existence, we are kind people, right? And as I mentioned, it's not something that demands a lot of hard work. In my experience, I think it's the easiest thing to be kind, right? You just need a couple of minutes a day or probably even less than that. And very small amount of effort, you can transform a human's day or some other person's week or even life. Right? And the return on investment, if you talk about, since we are investors, the return on investments is just off the charts, right? And I think if you were to think that way as well, if you just only look at the return on investment and if you were to be selfish in being kindness, I think please go ahead and do it. So that is my advice to even people. Do it for your own selfish reason, right? Because the best thing, like we also talk about the second and third order effects in life, I think the best thing is that with kindness, right, it also creates a ripple effect and it spreads from one person to another. It comes back to you, right? And it originates from a simple act of doing no harm to others. Like Hippocrates talked about in the oath to doctors, right? First, do no harm. That is an act of kind. You can be kind to others when you empathize with them, right? Even when you're looking at businesses and managements, right? It's very easy for us to be armchair analysts and say, oh, this management screwed up and they've been bad capital allocators and they could have done this to improve their business and they could have done that to improve their business, right? And this is a mistake that they make. Sometimes I think we need to empathize with those managers who are actually running their businesses and we are just investors, like someone said, as parasites on those companies trying to earn our share of returns, right? So if you just be empathetic to people, whether managers or otherwise, you are being kind. When you treat others the way they want to be treated, you are being kind. When you appreciate others for their work, you are being kind. When you forgive others for their mistakes, you are being kind, right? So there's someone who said that everyone in the world that you meet is fighting a battle, right? Everyone you meet in the world is lonesome, is lonely, right? So I think given this, that everyone is fighting their own battles and we don't know of those battles, I think the one simple big choice that we have is to deal more kindly and compassionately with others, right? Yeah. That's, I think, our only hope to live happily ourselves. So again, a selfish reason. And also to leave this world a better place than we found it. So I think there's no doubt about it. Talking about the second idea that you asked me about, being okay when things are not. I think it's the idea which is ingrained in our scriptures. Wherever you go, whichever religion or whichever scripture that you pull out, there's this idea of equanimity, right? Which simply means that you be calm and you be composed, right? And especially in a difficult situation. So there's this task that was given, I think, there are various versions of the story. So there was this king that gave a task to one of the courtiers to find those or to find that statement that is true in all circumstances. And this courtier goes around the world and meets the wisest people out there, right? And he comes back to the king with four words in a statement. He says that this too shall pass, right? I think when you live your life with the idea of this too shall pass, you can be composed, you can be calm, you can be equanimous, even when things are not okay, right? So I think every person in his or her lifetime, we always feel pressures and pains by experiencing the happiness out there, the sorrows out there. We get the respect, we sometimes get this disrespect. We suffer from cold, we suffer from heat. In the stock markets, we see bull markets, we see bear markets, we make money, we lose money, right? When we learn to be unruffled by all of these, and it's a very difficult thing to do, but we can definitely learn and practice to be unruffled by all of these over a period of time. And when we try to, I think, live in a spirit of peace with a very balanced mind, that is where we are practicing this idea of equanimity, as simple as that, right? And as I mentioned, it comes from across various backgrounds, various scriptures. So there's this Buddhist text called Therigatha, where there's a short poem that reads that if your mind becomes firm like a rock and no longer shakes in a world where everything is shaking, your mind will be your greatest friend and suffering will not come your way. So that's the Buddhist poem. I think in my experience, to have a mind that is our greatest friend, that is something that most of us want, right? And the mind that does not shake is a description of the mind that is equanimous. So I love simplifying stuff because I try to teach a lot of these things to younger adults and younger students in colleges and also to my kids, right? So the way I simplify is that equanimity, I think, is about living life in a constant calm and a constant state of contentment, right? It's about not letting the waves of everyday life throw us off our strides, right? Or the emotions of those around us weaken our spirit, right? So even when things do not turn out the way we want them to, which is true for most of us all the time, right? We want something, we get something else, right? It obviously causes the mind to get ruffled, right? But in those times, like I think Rudyard Kipling said in this beautiful poem, If, right? If you can treat those imposters of triumph and disaster alike, right, with equanimity, I think that is a good life to live. Coming to just a last example of, say, Indian scriptures, and there's a scripture called Bhagavad Gita, right, in India, where there's a conversation on the battlefield of Mahabharata between Lord Krishna and his disciple Arjun, right? So Krishna advises Arjun that as we move or as we wade through the ocean of life, right, it will throw up all kinds of waves that are beyond our control, right? If we keep struggling to eliminate negative situations, right, then in that case, we will be unable to avoid unhappiness, right? But if we can learn to accept everything that comes our way, right, triumphs and disasters, losses and gains, pains and troubles, happiness and sadness, right, with complete equanimity, with complete calmness and sameness of mind, right, without sacrificing our best efforts, I think that will be our true bliss. So I think if you were to live in bliss, in complete peace, in a world like we talked about in the case of Diogenes and how the world has changed, right, you can still live in a noisy, confusing world with complete bliss if you live with an equanimous mind. So I think that combines my answer to the previous question as well.
That's beautiful. I have so many thoughts about kindness when you think about it. It costs nothing. Most of the time to be kind, sometimes it's a smile, sometimes it's a hello. And I think of the butterfly effect, that being nice to one person can reach 1,000 or 1,000,000 people, because they will go home and be nice to their spouses, they will be nice to their kids, and the kids will be nice to the other kids. And I think the impact it can have, I think it's huge. You can see it in larger groups immediately. That's why Omaha's Berkshire meeting really made me think of just kindness. Then you touched on so many points that being a silent partner in a business, when I'm thinking of a shareholder and we piggyback on somebody else's success as a shareholder, being that silent partner, the important part that Buffett talks about is that you are treated the same way as the big shareholders. And I think that's something that we take for granted in some places. But it's also an expression of kindness that you treat all the shareholders in a certain way, the same way you would treat yourself. I think that's very important. The more you look at investing, the more you realize it's less about numbers. It's more about behavior and people and emotions and kindness and feelings and respect and so on. It's really fascinating because people look at investing as a place where you just need a formula and I'll tell you how to get rich. But I think it gets much more nuanced and complicated the more you look at it and the more time you spend investigating it. But speaking of formulas, it's a formula that you propose in your book, or at least I see it as a formula. You talk about how frugality leads to liberty and the magic of compounding helps even more. Talk to me about that, because there are truths that I see that rhyme and repeat across so many different sources and people feel like it's a secret, but I think it's a secret, but it's so out in the open. The only thing left is to actually embrace it and pursue it. So talk to me about frugality, and you mentioned compounding, which is such a powerful idea that some people just get it, and some people need a minute to get comfortable with it.
I'm sure. I think, like with so many other ideas that we've gotten all wrong, right, in terms of wrong formula and wrong assumptions, wrong practices out there. I think the idea of wealth is something that a lot of people also get it wrong. So I gave the example of Mike Tyson in the book, right, how he, after earning so much money from his boxing and sponsorships and everything, he still went bankrupt because of his expensive lifestyle, like spending around $400,000 a month just to maintain his expensive lifestyle. And ultimately, he went bankrupt out there, right? Because I think that's the same problem that he suffered from. He equated his income as wealth, right? And that's something, that's a big idea that I talk about when I talk about wealth creation with new people, right? If you make a good income each year and you spend it all, right, you are not getting wealthier. You are just living high, right? So wealth is is what you accumulate over a period of time, what you create over a period of time, not what you spend. What remains with you is the wealth, right? So the question is, how do you become wealthy, right? I think here too, most people have it wrong. It's not pure luck or inheritance or advanced degree or even intelligence that enables people to get good enough wealth, right? It's more often a result of, I think, three very important factors. The first, as you rightly mentioned, frugality. The second is the idea of compounding. And third is, like Buffett says, a snowball and a really long hill, which means a long time. So frugality, compounding, and a long period of time, right? Of course, I think I agree that life is not just about money and compounding. You must not aim to live a lonely and miserly life, right? And you stretch the idea of delayed gratification too far. I think that's also, sometimes we take this idea of frugality too far, right? The marshmallow experiment. You don't eat the marshmallow, but I have come to believe that if you have 10 marshmallows, you should consume at least 3 or 4 now to enjoy the present, and you save the remaining 6 or 7 for the future, right? So don't take this idea of compounding or delayed gratification too far. But I think here I am, since I'm talking purely about financial wealth, right, which when adequate enables us to create the freedom that we talked about, right, we want to enjoy someday. We need to be frugal. We need to understand the meaning of compounding. We also need to benefit or try and benefit from the importance of having a long time horizon. So when we combine these three powerful forces, we can create what we know as financial freedom out there, right? So Morgan Housel, who wrote this wonderful book called The Psychology of Money, right? He, in his book, he covers a lot about independence and freedom out of money, financial freedom, and how do we look at wealth and money and all those kind of things, right? So in one of the passages, I think on financial freedom, he mentions that, or I think one of the chapters on the true independence that you can have in life around money, he says that, I think being able to wake up one morning and change what you are doing, right, on your own terms, whenever you are ready, that seems like the grandmother of all financial goals, right? And he also writes that independence does not mean you will stop working, right? That is not what the real meaning of independence is, right? It means you only do the work you like with people you like at the times you want for as long as you want. So there's a simple definition. You can draw an illustration out of it, right? So just to repeat, right? Freedom, he says, it means you only do the work you like. You do the work with people you like. You do the work at times you want and for as long as you want. And there's no stopping you, right? And achieving some level of independence does not rely on earning a doctor's income, he says. It's mostly a matter of keeping your expectations in check and living below your means. So I think that's a very liberating idea, to live below your means and also a free life at the same time, right? Talking about compounding, I think in its simplest form, we all understand that compounding means earning interest on interest. That's a basic math that we have, right? So just to give a simple math again here for the audience, if someone does not understand, it's like $100 or 100 rupees when you invest, that earns 10% interest annually, right? You will have 110 rupees by the end of the first year. In the second year, the 10% interest will be calculated on the 110 and not 100, right? And so it will be 11 rupees or $11 as you may want to count, right? And this way, as years go by and the longer you give that money to compound, right? Not only does the base on which your compound interest is calculated grows, right? But also does the interest amount. That's the magic, right? But the question is, it's simple math. Where is the magic in it, right? So the magic for most people who don't understand, who know the power of compounding, but who don't understand the real power of compounding, the magic starts appearing when you let your money grow this way, like uninterrupted for 10 years, for 20 years, or 30 years, right? This is where the numbers explode, because this is Time, I think, as we understand, is the most powerful variable in compounding. It's not the rate of return, though you still need to earn a positive rate of return. But I think the longer amount of time that you give, like Buffett says, having a long hill and you just roll your snowball, right? Just giving an example of Buffett again, right? He bought his first stock at the age of 11, right? But he has earned 99% of his wealth after his 50th, probably 55th birthday, because that is the exponential power of compound interest. It's back end. It gets activated only when you give it time it requires, right? Not months or years, but probably decades, right? And that is why when I meet young people, and my advice to young people or anyone who's interested, right, on the idea of compounding and creating wealth and getting the right definition of wealth creation, right? You need to start rolling your snowball of savings as early as possible to benefit from what Buffett calls a really long hill, right? Of course, as I mentioned, you should not sacrifice your present. And you should not stash away every bit of your savings to compound in the future. That's not the idea. But the idea is to start early and save as much as you can. Be frugal in your life, right? Enjoy your present, but also be frugal. Invest the balance and then have enough patience. Like Ben Franklin said, that you need to see your money make money. And the money that your money makes more money, right? I think compound interest is simply elementary math and one of the most powerful models available for us to understand. And the best part is that it works not just on money, it works on everything in life, every good thing in life, whether it's habit, whether it's relationship, things that can grow in life over a period of time will benefit from compounding. The idea is to start early, start small, and I think let time work its magic, right? So I think you also, if I remember right, connected with this idea of compounding and frugality somewhere, you also use the word enough. Right, that sometimes we've forgotten the idea of how much is enough, which I think is also a very important question, right? I also remember a story that I first read a few years back, and a lot of your audience may have already heard it, but for the benefit of others as well, let me just repeat that story about how this powerful of idea of enough can actually sink in, right? So there's this party given by a billionaire, right, on an island, and there are two authors, Kurt Vonnegut, we know of, and there's his friend, Joseph Heller, the Catch-22 book author, right? So Kurt Vonnegut tells Joseph Heller that the host of the party, who's a hedge fund manager, he's made more money in a single day than Heller had earned from his wildly popular novel Catch-22 over the entire history, right? And Heller responds that, despite that, I have something that he will never have. And Kurt Vonnegut is surprised at, what could you have that this rich person, rich hedge fund manager would not have? And Heller says that the idea that I have enough, right? Now, that's such a simple yet powerful thought, right? Most of the times we don't even stop to ask this question. And when we do, we are not seeking an answer to how much is enough, but only a way to shift the goalpost of enough, right? Which I think is a sad reality of life. So just stopping by to answer this question of how much is enough, knowing what is enough for you. And again, going back to the same point, once you realize that you have enough, it does not mean that you stop working, right? It simply means that you know that you have enough to live a life without any financial worries. And probably that time you can choose to live a life of your own choice, choose the people that you want to work with your own choice, choose the time of your own choice, right? That is what true freedom, real freedom is all about, right? Combining the ideas of Mallory, combining the ideas of Morgenhauser talks about, combining the ideas of what Diogenes talk about in terms of living a free life, right? It all boils down to the same thing, right? Be true to yourself, be authentic to yourself, know what is enough for you, and I think you'll be fine.
I love the sound of that, and you're collecting all those little ideas from all over. I wrote down getting rich slowly, because that's the philosophy behind it. And the second thing I thought of is how we overestimate how much we can do in a day, and we underestimate how much we can do in a year or a decade. And with investing, it's the same. I like that you mentioned and reminded us how Buffett made 99% of what he has today after his 55th birthday, and I think 97% after his 70th birthday, and so on. But the idea is that the majority of his wealth was created later on through compounding. And that's a great visual to have and to see how wealth gets compounded and created over time. When I think of freedom, and you talk about the fact that once you have wealth, it's not that you don't have to do anything. You get to choose what you're going to do. And it's such a big question and a thought that a lot of people don't really have a moment to think about and ponder for a second. when you think about it, if money was not an issue, what would you be doing with your life?
There's this wonderful, sorry to interrupt, I think there's this wonderful small lecture from the British author Alan Watts, right, which I was talking to, which I shared with the students of my class just a couple of days back. And that lecture is highly advisable. The title of the lecture is "What Do You Desire?" Right, and he says that when he meets college student, right, the first thing that he asks them is that if money was out of the picture, right, what would you be doing in life if their money was not a problem, right? And a lot of kids would say that, okay, I would want to become a painter, I would want to become an artist or a writer or a philosopher or a thinker, I would want to ride horses or play games and all those kind of things. And Alan Watts tells them that if that is the case, do that. Right? Because if you're really passionate about something, if you really work on something, work on yourself in terms of improving yourself in that area, because you also enjoy doing that with complete freedom, over a period of time, you will get better at it. And once you get better at it, you are going to command the money that you want to out of it, right? So you're anyway going to earn money out of that, not by first focusing on money, but by first focusing on the question of what do you really desire, right? So once you answer that question, what do you really desire, it may in high probability lead you to all the wealth that you want over a period of time. Mm.
I like that. Have you heard of the term obliquity as indirectly achieving your goals? How happiness, for example, is not something that we can directly pursue. Happiness kind of sneaks up on us, and companies obsess about profits and do a lot of things that actually will not serve them in the long run just to reach that objective of a higher profit. I want to talk about losses and mistakes and being wrong. Kind of combine the two ideas that you talk about in your book. One is the goal and the aspiration to minimize the cost of being wrong. And the second side to it is how we perceive gain and loss in a different way. We gain $100, or if we lose $100, it's not the same experience. And somehow I'm thinking of drawdowns, how our minds sometimes lock in this high water mark for the account, for example, and we remember that it was $1 million and now it's 950. And there's a certain pain associated with it, a discomfort. And I see very clearly, the more I've been in the business, that it really affects the decision making. So talk to me more about minimizing mistakes, pain of loss, and then living in a drawdown as an investor, which is probably 99% of the time, you're somewhere below the peak.
I think that's true, again, with all things that we do in life, that we have a chance of going wrong over there and also hitting upon bad luck out there, right? So just to give an example from my own life, right? And again, when I talk about the idea of minimizing the cost of being wrong, to be very clear and specific, I am here talking about the very important concept of margin of safety. Right, because we understand that we are going to go wrong. Life is unknown, right? There are a lot of unknowables in life, right? You don't know when that bullet from Taleb's example of Russian roulette is going to hit you, right? The earlier you prepare for it, the more you prepare for it, though you may still get it wrong, right? But I think you will end up minimizing the cost of going wrong. So just to give an example, again, from my personal life, which I also wrote about in the sketchbook, is of a story of this event which happened in 2011 when I had just quit my job, right? And we've already got to know that my second child was on the way, right? And despite that, I quit my job because I had to work on what I'm doing now, right? That was the ultimate idea of my life at that point of time. So I quit my job. I got my last salary check in somewhere in April of 2011. And my son was born just the next month, May of 2011. And he was born in the seventh month, so he was a premature child. And though I had kept around two years of savings for things going wrong, which I assume that something is going to go wrong somewhere, because I'm leaving a high-paying job for a career in uncertainty at this point of time. I'm not sure about what I would want to do in life. But I ensured that I had those 2 years of savings. I had no financial liability, and I had a complete support of my family before I quit my job in 2011. So he was born in 2011, May, just a month after I left my job and got the last salary check. And since we had to spend almost like 20 days in hospital, right, the hospitalization cost in India, you have to pay out of your own pocket. right? There's no medical cover that covers pregnancy or childbirth in India, right? So that took away almost 50% of my savings out there, right? So it's like a black swan thing for me, a big shock, right? You leave your job with 2 years of saving, thinking that if nothing happens in your business or in your work for 2 years, it will still be fine. And suddenly an event happens that takes away 50% of your money. So you are not sure how to react, whether you're happy because your child is born or be a bit despondent because you've lost a lot of your financial cushion that you started with, right? So in hindsight, when I look back at those days, I think the only thing that saved me emotionally and financially was having that cushion, having that 2 years of saving, having no financial liability, having complete support of my family. And also the fact that I had built up my skills in terms of doing what I wanted to do in life. So there were multiple levers of margin of safety that I had applied that point of time. And margin of safety for the uninitiated, I think it's an engineering concept, but it applies to all areas of life, whether it's personal finance, right? Whether it's stress management, whether it's time management, right? So when you apply margin of safety, not just to investing, but to all these areas of life, you take care of your health before the health worsens or before age strikes you. You take care of your personal finances before an eventuality happens or something that really hits you on your personal finance front. You probably meditate, you take care of your mental health before you meet a stressful moment because you're better prepared for it, right? You need to be much more prepared for eventualities in life, something that, or more often they come out of the blue and you have no inkling of when they are going to come and how severe that would be. So I think it's so important, this idea of margin of safety, which again, I first heard from Ben Graham, who talked about this idea and in The Intelligent Investor. But then as I have studied this idea much more deeper and I've experienced life over the last 10, 15 years of practicing this idea of margin of safety everywhere, on everything I do, I can without doubt say that this is one of the most important concepts in living a life, which will have its setbacks, right? But again, connecting with the idea of equanimity, you can be equanimous when you have enough cushion, right? You cannot be equanimous if you are down on the street and you have lost everything, right? It's very difficult to be equanimous, right? So when I say equanimity is one of the ways of living a sane and peaceful life, when you are calm and composed, there has to be a margin of safety which really leads you to be calm and composed at all times, right? So it's very easy to go wrong sometimes, right? It's very easy to see bad luck coming your way. And as investors, we completely understand that we always on the unlucky side of the game, right? When we buy stocks, the stocks start falling. And when we sell stocks, the stocks start rising, right? And the moment we need a lot of money or some money for our financial requirements, that is the time the markets are down. So there's so many situations of bad luck out there, right, that we have to face. Given all that, the idea of margin of safety, I think, is one of the most important things that any investor, any decision maker, or any person in life, whether it's a student or any person of any age, will do good for himself, herself by practicing this idea or by incorporating this idea as a safety net, right, to suffer or to go through all these bad times and come out stronger. So it's like something that doesn't kill you, makes you stronger, right? So only those things that will not kill you, only when you have marginal safety, then you'll survive to live another day, right? So it also goes with the idea of what I think Peter Bernstein said, that the only road to riches is survival, right? Or Buffett says that if you want to finish first in a race, you need to first finish the race, right? Which means you need to first arrive, you need to first survive, right? So I think the most important skill in investing is to survive those 20, 30 years. Because if you don't survive those 20, 30 years, you're not going to compound wealth, right? The ultimate idea of creating wealth is because you want to need that money in the future for some financial goals. Or if you're like Buffett, you're just enjoying the process. Yeah, you don't need as much money. You have enough. You're just enjoying the process even when you are 95 year of age. But for most other mortal beings, I think wealth creation is a process of meeting their financial goals in the future, right? But if you don't survive and if you don't have enough margin of safety, if going wrong can cost you heavy, right? I think that those are bad things that can happen. So employ that idea of margin of safety. And I have no doubt that's one of the most powerful idea in investing or otherwise. Talking about the psychology of loss, right? And I think this is what loss aversion is all about, right? And we also understand that losing, say, $100 will give us twice the pain as earning those same $100, right? So 2x the pain as the pleasure from winning the same amount. So I think it's again such an important idea that we hate losses. And in the book as well, I wrote about the story of Lance Armstrong, the world-renowned cyclist who had won the Tour de France, the most difficult cycling tournament in the world, multiple times. And then ultimately, he was found doping, right? Drug scandal and all those things came out. And in an interview after that scandal came out and someone asked him about doping and everything, he said that winning was the most important thing for me because losing for me meant death. Right. And if losing for you means death, which means you will do anything and everything in the world to avoid that loss. Right. So as investors as well, we suffer from this loss aversion bias. And as I mentioned, the pain of a 10% decline is twice the pleasure of a 10% gain. Right. So that leads us to make all those mistakes of selling our good quality stocks and winning stocks because we are averse to losses and we think that let me sell that stock before I lose any paper profit that I've earned in it. On the other hand, in contrast, we hold on to our losing businesses and bad businesses in our portfolio because again, here, the pain of converting that paper loss into real loss is really bad, right? So we keep holding on to those bad companies in our portfolio because we are averse to losses, right? So that is the psychology of loss. I think it can lead us astray, right? And there are multiple biases that are connected to the psychology of loss, right? So loss aversion is the one thing that I'm talking about. Because of loss aversion, we also fall into what is known as the sunk cost fallacy, right? So since you have invested or you spent so much time researching a stock, you've invested so much money in the stock, and if you realize later that you made a mistake, you will put in more money and put in more time just to prove that you are right and you're not wrong, right? That also goes with commitment and consistency biases. So mind is a tricky thing to handle as far as investing is concerned, right? Even when you understand these biases, even when you understand the mental models, and even when you are a teacher of mental models and you try to think that you are smarter than others, you also fall for these same biases again and again, right? So I think the idea is to have enough margin of safety because you are going to suffer yourself despite knowing all this. And also the idea is to have the humility to understand that you are human, you are going to make mistakes, right? And that is the only way you can minimize the losses or the cost of these biases. You cannot eliminate them. So that is something which I have understood over years, that you cannot eliminate biases, you cannot eliminate being loss averse, how much ever you know about it, how much ever you read about or talk about it. And also from an evolutionary point of view, right? Our brains are not wired to be rational thinkers. Right. If you just look at the idea of averting losses, right, when it comes to investing, we may think, oh, it's a wrong thing to do to avert losses. You must take the risk and all those kind of things. But if our ancestors had not averted losses like diseases or predation, right, we would not have been here. They survived because they averted all those losses. They ran away as soon as they saw the first sign of fear or danger. Right. And that's the reason we are here. We are talking today. Right. So we exist because a lot of people in our past, they avoid losses, right? As much as possible. They're scared of losses. So by nature, the way our brains are developed, I think it's perfectly fine being loss averse. But in areas when we need to make decision making under, or we need to make decisions under uncertainty, I think we need to be very careful of what we take from our ancestors and what we really practice, right? So most of the ideas that we think are foolish in investing, they are perfectly fine in real life, right? But we need to understand the difference between applying them in investing and applying them in real life. So when it's a matter of life and death, please go and apply. Please apply what Kahneman talks about as system one thinking and don't be reflective. Just run away to save your life. But when it comes to investing or making decisions under uncertainty, and if it's not a matter of life and death, think about those things. Think reflectively. Give it time, right? Over a period of time, you'll understand it. Reflection is what leads you to better decision. It's not haste. It's only reflection.
It feels like investors, especially value-driven investors, they look at their value. They look at the value of what they buy and they override a lot of the evolutionary baggage that we come with because we get excited when prices go down as value investors. Then we buy more shares. We get excited when the stock misses expectations because we can buy more shares. In a way, we zigzag through the world, not in accordance with what you would think our evolutionary brains would tell us to do. and we don't run away from panic. We actually go in and get excited about it. So I think there's a peculiar thing that's something you can cultivate, but also maybe you're born with it. I don't know, but that allows you to benefit from those moments in public markets. I always say that I like to be the least wrong. And I really like the concept because I think people come to investing to be right or to prove everybody else wrong. But I think if you start with yourself, because that's the only part you have control over, I can try to be the least wrong. And I like the idea of an infinite plan or an infinite investment horizon, having a very long run, maybe something that spans multiple generations. I work with people that inherited or created wealth, and they think in terms of a very long-term game. The last thing they want is to ever start from scratch again. And I think it's a very powerful concept. They never want to be at zero all over again. I think Munger talked about how the first 100,000 is the hardest, and second thing he said was that he never wants to start from zero again.
That's right.
And I think if you keep that in mind, every decision that you make, not just an investment decision, but also, for example, friendship, if you see it as an infinite game, there are certain things that can undermine the friendship, and the friendship is gone. So when you think about the Russian roulette, there are certain risks in life that are just not worth taking, no matter how much money you have. That's what I find.
That's fascinating.
So you have another podcast, and it's called The Inner Game with Vishal. And I was listening to an episode not long ago that really spoke to me, and I wanted to bring it up today since I have you with me. You say that your wealth is like your children. It's your primary link between your present and the future. I'm curious to hear more, because I also think that wealth is a link between today and the past and the future, the sacrifices, the compromises that you had to make for the money to even be here today for us to talk about it. But tell me more how you see wealth like your children.
I think again, as I write, if I talk in again and again, none of the ideas that I write or talk about are my original ideas. I've learned them from the best minds out there. And I think that really keeps me humble that there's so much that I know nothing. Right. And I, that's what keeps me in terms of being a learning machine and always being willing to ideas and learn from people who passed us by, who've left us lessons that would last a lifetime and beyond as well. So again, this idea that I talked about in the podcast, The Inner Game, I first heard it from Peter Bernstein, who's one of my favorite authors and financial historian, right? And he's one of the best guys who want to learn about risk in investing. So a couple of his book, Capital Ideas and Against the Gods, The Story of Risk, I think I can highly recommend to anyone who wants to understand the idea of risk in investing, right? So it was Peter who said that your wealth is like your children, and they are the, it's a primary link between your present and the future, like your children, right? Right. So he also said that you should try to think about it in the same way. You want your children to have freedom, but you also want them to be good people who can take care of themselves, right? So in the same way, when it comes to wealth, right, you need to be having the freedom to use that wealth for your advantage to live a life that you want to do. But you also need to, like you want your kids to be good people who can take care of themselves, responsible people. You also have that responsibility of managing your wealth well, right? It's not just about freedom, because freedom without responsibility is mania, is havoc, right? So you need to combine both of them, right? And Peter also suggests that you don't want to blow it because you don't get a second chance, right? A lot of people come to the markets and a lot of people start investing and start trying to build their wealth as if they'll have multiple chances. I think one of the simplest ideas that I think about, and I think about a lot, is that the sequence matters, right? Make lose is different than lose make, right? Once you make something, once you build wealth, or once you do the right things to build wealth when you are younger, right? You can still lose a part of it and still survive. But if you start with a loss and you start with a big loss, then it's very difficult to make that up again, right? Because you're scarred for life. It's not about losing money. You're scarred for life, right? So a lot of people think about second chance and third chance. It may happen. It may not happen, right? But if you blow it away, it's a very rare thing that you're going to get a second chance to building it. Right. And when I talk about blowing away, I'm not talking about stock prices jumping up and down. I'm talking about losing your money permanently, losing your wealth permanently. Right. So this is a wonderful idea that I think is such an important concept for people in the markets or people otherwise as well who are trying to build their wealth through businesses to think about, right, and to reflect and to practice, right? So when you invest, right, it's not your wealth. Again, this is what Peter says, it's not your wealth. It's your future that you are really managing, right? It's not about the money that you're going to spend today. It's the money that you're going to create for the future to live a life when probably you're not earning money, right? So I think this idea of equating wealth with one of the most precious things in our life, more than wealth, which is our children, I think it's a very important idea because it urges us to contemplate or think about the way we handle our wealth. And I think I find this to be a very profound perspective. Now, the question is that I also answered in the podcast about how do you think like that? How do you do that, right? So I think the answers, again, are as simple as thinking and acting long-term, like you would do with your children. You don't want them to become something, or you don't want to grow up into individuals on the very next day or the next month. It's a long-term effort, right? Parenting is a long-term effort without any paybacks probably, right? You're not expecting any paybacks out here, right? You also need to balance freedom, as I mentioned, of enjoying the wealth and also the responsibility of managing it, right? So you want your kids to be free, but you also want them to be responsible and not be free without responsibility. So both ways, right? And I think the idea that a lot of people look at wealth as just money and assets, I think that is not what I look at wealth as. And this is what I've learned from Peter and other people, right? Or even Buffett or other people, right? Wealth is basically, I think, a reflection of our values. It is a reflection of our hopes about the future. It's a reflection of our dreams for the future. And so I suggest that in my podcast that we should approach our financial journey with the same care, with the same love, with the same philosophical depth that we apply to raising our children, right? And the way we nurture our children, the way we nurture our wealth, I think the balance we strike between freedom and responsibility and the legacy that we intend to build with it, I think all of that shapes not just our financial well-being, all of that also shapes the world we leave behind. I think it's a responsibility. It's not just enjoying wealth. It's your responsibility to manage it in a very sound manner.
I like the connection between the past, the present, and the future. And what wealth can be is this link between us today and the future selves. And I'm thinking of the book by Hal Hirschfeld, The Future Self, that really spoke to me because it explains how you today and you 20 years from now is the same person, but not the same person. And he really takes you in this book on this philosophical journey. How would you treat your future self? What is it that you can do today so that your future self could benefit? And wealth, money, capital is such a visual idea of what this amount can be in the future, but there's so much more to it. That kind of connection, whether it's between you today and you in the future, or you and the future generations, or you and the past generations. And it's not just money, but I'm thinking also ideas, knowledge, principles, things that we talked about today, and how we experience it. Vishal, I want to ask you a big one before you go. I want to ask you about money and happiness. And in your podcast, you talk about whether money can buy happiness or if we can say we can sell happiness for money. Tell me more about that.
In fact, I realized that that was not the right question to ask in that podcast. The content that I was talking about was exactly not about can money buy happiness. But I asked this question to my son, who's 12 years old. And he said, yes, money can buy happiness, right? Right. You do the podcast. And he told me that you're doing a podcast. You have a computer. You have a good camera, you have a good background of books and everything, and you bought that all through money, and that gives you happiness. So money can buy happiness to a certain extent, I'm sure, right? So that's a very interesting perspective, right? How much ever we say that money cannot buy happiness, we need to reach that stage where we have enough money to even say that thing, that money cannot buy happiness, right? So so I did this episode, I think just yesterday, where I talked about this survey done by a financial services company in the US called Empower Group. And they actually tried to find out the difference between different generations and how they look at money and happiness, right? And how much money do you need to be happy, or what net worth do you need to be happy? So as per their survey, and this is just some numbers I remember, right? So around 60%, and this is basically an American audience, Americans who were surveyed, right? So The survey said that around 60% of Americans think that money can buy happiness, but the amount varies, right? And out of that, the average number, the average American said that they would need around a net worth of $1.2 million to think that they are happy in life, right? The very surprising part was not $1.2 million. The very surprising part was that millennials or people born between 1981 and 1996 or people just around our age, right? Or slightly younger. They think that it's not $1.2 million, it's $1.7 million to be happy, right? And even surprising was the Gen Zs, who are the current generation, right? People who were born between 1997 and 2010, the youngest generation out there, my kids and my daughter and my son and all those ages, right? They think that only $487,000 is enough to be happy of net worth, right? So when you go around and you think, okay, the youngsters are spoiled people and they want to spend all that kind of money and then they are running after money, you realize that it's our generation that thought that you need more money to be happy or you need a bigger network to be happy. So when I was reading about the survey and when I was thinking about it and when I was researching more about the idea of money and happiness, I came across these two quick ideas from philosophy, right? So one is called materialism, which emphasizes that material wealth is the key to happiness, right? But there's a contrasting idea called existentialism, which simply means that it's not wealth, but meaning in life, finding purpose in life and personal experience in life are more important than wealth, right? So for our generation of people, or people who are millennials, were born like 1980s to mid-1990s, right? We've focused on too much material wealth. So for us, money has become a commodity, right? To trade for happiness, to get stuff and all those kind of things. And surprisingly, for the youngest generation out there, the social connections that they built, the ease of travel, the ease of meeting and talking to people, the meanings that they get in life, the purpose that we all talk about, right? The personal experience that they gain using little amount of money that they have, they think that is all that they need in life, which was a very surprising thing. So money can buy happiness, as again the survey proves, but it differs from person to person. From a very psychological standpoint, I think we've all heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Once our basic needs like food, clothing, shelter, and Wi-Fi are met, right, then we move towards the higher needs like esteem or self-actualization. This is what Maslow's hierarchy talks about, right? But the problem here is that we end up being on that hedonic treadmill, right? We suffer from that hedonic adaptation where the more we need, the more we want, the more we end up wanting and needing, right? So there's a never-ending treadmill right. that we are on, right? So I think that's a problem with millennials as far as the survey goes, right? So it entirely depends on when you were born, what kind of situations you were born, right? How you've lived your early life, what kind of family environment you had, what kind of opportunities you had, what kind of world you lived in, right? So there's no right and wrong. There's no black and white over here, right? But I think it's all entirely situation dependent, age dependent. It's also dependent, I think, on personal values, right? It's such an important thing. It's life goals are such an important thing, right? Everyone has unique aspirations, I understand. Everyone has a different definition of success, right? So for some people, success means financial security. It means wealth accumulation. And it's the most important thing, right? For a lot of others, what matters is relationships. What matters is experiences. What matters is personal growth. And these things hold more value, right? So coming back to the same question, can money buy happiness? I think yes, to a certain level, right? Now the question is, how much money do you need to buy happiness or to get happy, right? I think the answer to that, again, is very nuanced. It depends from person to person. There's no right answer. But it's very good to know your personal threshold. It's very good to know, coming back to the same point, how much is enough for you. Not enough in a general thumb rule definition, but how much is enough for you. And I think the real question out of all this thing, instead of asking, can money buy happiness, right? How much money you need to be happy is not that important. I think, what kind of life do you want to lead and what role does money play in that vision? I think asking or answering that question of what kind of life do you want to lead and what role would money play in that vision of the life that you want to lead? I think that's a much more important question than simply asking or simply worrying about can money buy happiness, because that's a very open-ended question. Everyone will have a different answer to that.
That's a good question to ask. I'm thinking of the idea of giving money meaning. It has to have a context and importance. What I like about what I do when I manage other people's money, I see that the money that I'm responsible for has significance, importance, meaning in their life. gives them options, even if it's not used, even if it's not spent. Just the fact that it's there, it allows them to see the world from a different perspective. It's one of the aspects that we talked about, the freedom of choice. You can choose whatever you want to do just because you know that it's there. Just like the cushion that you talked about, the 2 years.
That's right. And I think I just...
savings.
Yeah. And another point, I think we talk about the idea of financial freedom, right? We talk about money and wealth helping us achieve financial freedom. I think over a period of time, I think that idea of financial freedom has also diluted the definition. The real definition of financial freedom has also diluted a bit for me, because financial freedom has also become a very missold kind of a product out there, right? So you will have a financial services company or stockbrokers or investment salesmen or everyone or companies selling beauty products or consumer good companies. Everyone wants you to buy their products because they think that you are unhappy in your life. You're not free in your life. You're always unhappy, right? And I think that need for more, the desire for more will keep us on that hedonic treadmill of, right, where we are always running, right? We think that there's a mirage, there's a treasure at the end of the rainbow, and we are running behind that rainbow of financial freedom because it's been missold to us, right? Because dreams have been shown to us that you can be financial free with so much amount of wealth only when you buy my insurance policy, or only when you buy my stock advice, or you buy my newsletter and all this kind of stuff. But I think it's all within, right? I think you need a certain amount of money to say that you have enough to not worry about money. But I think beyond that, it's only a scorecard that you are playing. You're only trying to get that scorecard in your favor compared to others. But it's never a game of comparison. Again, you need to know how much freedom you feel with whatever amount of money, not living in a barrel like Diogenes, but having enough money to not worry about money. And understanding that financial freedom is more a mindset after a certain amount of net worth, right? Beyond that, you keep running, and you don't go anywhere. So there was this very, I don't know who said it, maybe some anonymous person who said that the trouble with the rat race is that even if you win, you are still a rat, right? So again, I think very, very important for us to decide what races we want to run, right? Whether it's after wealth or money. It's after the purpose and the fulfillment that we get out of life and money and things like that.
Vishal, how do you think about success? What does it mean to you? Is it a destination? Is it a journey? How do you know you're on the right track?
Well, I think it's changed a lot over the last many years. Again, as I've sort of matured, probably my hair have grayed, right, over a period of time. And also as I realize that there's so much to learn in this world, and the idea of humility all around, that you cannot be arrogant and live a life with sanity. You need to be humble enough to understand that you need to change a lot of your definitions and change a lot of your mind on the most important subjects. And success is one of them, right? So earlier it was money, it was designation, it was power. And like is usual for all young people to think what success is all about, right? But I think over a period of time, that definition has, on the work front, I think it's moved to a deep sense of purpose that I get from the work that I'm doing, that defines success for me, right? The alignment of my vocation with my passion and values that I have in life, right? Probably the ability to make a meaningful impact in the life of others, right? So I think these are the definitions, or these are the ideas of success, I think, that has evolved over a period of time for me. I think, in a sense, success for me, it becomes a reflection. I think it is a reflection of the authenticity, right, of one's journey and their contribution to the greater good that is out there in the world. So that is one way of looking at success. I think on a more personal front, right, I think I have also moved to the idea of looking less and less at external validation, right, and more and more towards the inner self or inner development out there, right? So more probably spiritual or probably psychological, philosophical development. Right, becoming much more self-aware, right, growing in my personal life, cultivating the virtues of things like empathy, things like resilience, things like equanimity, things like compassion to others, right, probably forging deep connections, right, with people. You, I've done, Hari, I've done over a period of time, I thank my fortune to be connected to you guys, good guys out there, right, and nurturing a sense of belonging in a world that I think often emphasizes too much of individualism. Right. So we are a community, right? And if we can, again, going back to the same idea of kindness, right? There's no hope. There's no hope or there's no help that is going to come from outside of this world. The only hope of right. living peacefully and with sanity in this world is to be kind to one another, right? Not look at success as a as a mile point that you need to cross somewhere, right? To achieve something in life, right? You just need to be happy in what you're doing, right? Rather than seeking validation outside, you just need to be living with an inner scorecard, right? You need to be kind to others. You need to be useful to others. Overall, I think the idea of success simply means, I think if in your life, you can be useful to yourself and useful to others, right? I think you've done more than enough. So just be happy about it.
I love that. Vishal, this was incredible. I highly recommend your book, your podcast, your resources. I'll include all the links in the notes for everybody that wants to explore more. We touched on so many wonderful topics. And what I love the most about it is that I think this conversation and the principles we talked about, they will be relevant today, in a month, and 1,000 years from today. We talked about some timeless ideas that affect all of us. We started talking about money, but we ended up touching on so many much bigger topics today. Vishal, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Bogomil. I think I enjoyed this. I loved talking to you as well. So your first time we're talking, but as you mentioned at the start of this session, right, it seems that you know me. I think I can say the same thing about you as well, right, after talking to you about things which are eternal, right? Because that is what I focus on in my podcast as well, in my books and in my writings as well, right? Stuff that people would read and still understand and appreciate even 10, 20, 50, 100 if things remain by that point of time. And it was one such conversation for me today. So probably one of my favorites. So thank you so much for the questions that you asked and the time that you spent with me. Thank you so much.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.